back next Sunday morning with music by Moskovsky, Sibelius and Poulenc, plus Brahms's Te Deum, Bruckner's Te Deum, as well as, you've guessed it, a little more Wagner. I'm James Jolly. I hope you've enjoyed my choice of music this morning. Thanks for your company and have a restful and enjoyable remainder of your weekend. Sunday Morning is a unique production for BBC Radio 3 with studio production today by Neil Miners.
On BBC Radio 3, Wagner 200. A week of programmes reflecting on one of music's most influential figures, a life every bit as titanic as the stupendous music dramas he invented. Wagner's music threaded through our weekday programmes on BBC Radio 3.
And I'll be exploring Wagner's life and music and the music of some of the composers who influenced him in Composer of the Week.
A Week of Wagner on BBC Radio 3.
This is Radio 3. It's 12 o'clock and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Harriet Harman is the longest-serving woman MP in Parliament and is currently Shadow Culture Minister and Shadow Deputy Prime Minister. Prior to entering Parliament, Harriet was legal officer for Liberty, and she's continued to embrace human rights and rights for women. She's held several ministerial positions and has for many years been at the very heart of Labour politics. One of her children, Amy, is joint principal bassoonist in the Philharmonia Orchestra. No mean feat. So I gather you must get to hear quite a bit of music one way or another.
Well, I do. It's wonderful for Amy to be so talented and for me to be able to follow her around listening to wonderful music, and terrific for her to be able to play with such a great orchestra as the Philharmonia under Esa-Pekka Salonen. It's a joy.
I think it must be very fascinating for a politician to begin to hear about the way in which an orchestra works and the way people have to listen to each other in order to get music right.
Well, I am a complete stage mum. I mean, I do follow it, and you see it from a completely different viewpoint when a family member or friend is in a particular seat in the orchestra. Actually, the Philharmonia have done an app called The Orchestra, which allows you to sit in a particular chair and hear the orchestra from different points of view. So second best at actually playing yourself, you can be in the chair and listening to the orchestra from different points within it.
Actually, your first piece embraces several issues that you care about, but it is principally the most extraordinarily dramatic piece. And it's also a very erotic idea, and it's Bluebeard's Castle, isn't it?
It is, because here is the lovely Judith, who goes as the young bride to Bluebeard. And he's got a marvellous castle, and we're full of hope and optimism for her. But that optimism gives way to a bit of a suspicion that things might not be right. And then it goes from bad to worse until finally the horror at the end, as she discovers the three previous wives, and she's going to join them as the fourth in terrible suffering. So she wants to change Bluebeard, to open up his castle. What a normal story that is. I'm going to marry him and change him for the better. But it really is a very gruelling depiction, no better depiction of domestic violence, I would say.
But also, I think it's quite interesting because there is a kind of, on her part, a sort of erotic fascination to carry on opening the doors, even when she knows that actually she's walking into trouble.
Well, I'm not sure I see it as an erotic fascination. I see it as like, oh, Judith, don't. You know, she just can't, because she's naive and enthusiastic and she doesn't realise that she's getting deeper and deeper. But the music is so dramatic and creates such a sense of terror at the end. And, of course, there's one point where you almost jump out of your seat. like, turn back, Judith. It's not going to work out all right. But she doesn't. She presses on. So.
But that's an amazing moment. That's the fifth door which they open, and it reveals his kingdom. But in some productions I've seen, there's this blinding light when that big chord comes, and they more or less turn the spotlight straight at the audience. And as you say, you are knocked out of your seat.
Was that the one at the Festival Hall you saw? Because they did it like that there, where you get a combination of the orchestra and that voice, which is almost a note, or is it a scream, and you're blinded at the same time. And the kind of jolt and the awe, the way the music takes you into that story, is just overwhelming.
People always talk about Stravinsky and Schoenberg and now Britten, but I do think that Bartok is one of the really great 20th century composers, and that the drama in that music illustrates that perfectly.
Absolutely.
We heard The Secret Garden from Bluebeard's Castle by Bartok. John Tomlinson sang Bluebeard, and Anzovi von Otter, Judith, with the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Bernard Haitink. Now, Harriet, I mentioned earlier that your daughter plays in the Philharmonia, and I can't help thinking that that might have guided your choice for our next music.
Well, I think that if you've got a family member who's a musician, and if you're not a musician, you listen to that instrument above all, and it's not just me, it's her mum listening to the bassoon. Her grandmother now listens to bassoon when she listens to orchestras. My sisters, it's your route into an orchestra. So this next piece, which is the Mozart Grand Partita, I know everybody else is listening to the oboe. They're then listening to the clarinet joining in, but I'm listening to the wonderful mellow tones of the bassoon underneath. Just listen out for it.
Thank you.
That's the piece they play at the beginning of the film Amadeus, where Salieri is listening to this in his head. He's in a mental institution and he's listening to it with an absolute sense of grief, because why can't he do that? It's so beautiful. And Mozart did it, and he didn't even have to cross out. It was almost like as if God was speaking directly to him for him to just communicate it onto the page. And I think you always have that sense with Mozart. How can anybody do that?
The Serenade in B-flat major, Kirkel 361, the Grand Partita, from which that was the third movement, the Adagio by Mozart, wind soloists of the Chamber Orchestra of Europe. Harriet, given what we've been talking about, I'm bound to mention that recently Maria Miller, your counterpart, said that we must, as it were, celebrate the financial success of the arts. And certainly we have had colossal success in the theatre, in painting, in literature, in music. But there's a danger, which Nick Heitner mentioned in riposte to this, that that success comes because areas where there is perhaps less obvious immediate financial return, they make the people that are going to be successful at the later stage.
Well, I think it's absolutely right to recognise that music, film, theatre, all the museums have been, everybody around the world admires them, and they've been great earners for us. They've employed people and they attract foreign currency into this country. But actually you can't support the arts in the way that you'd support the car industry. You have to invest in creativity all around the country, and especially in children, because you don't know where it's going to emerge from. You have to have a culture of creativity. You can't simply plan to invest in a blockbuster. It's not like that. You have to take artistic risk. But we know we're good at it. We know it's important. But it's also not just important for the economy and for the jobs and growth, but actually it's important to opportunity for individuals, their sense of identity, the sense of the definition of local communities. So if she's going to try and persuade George Osborne that money should be invested in the arts, I'm with her all the way. But she should try and persuade Michael Gove as well that it should be, creativity should be right in the heart of the curriculum. But I don't think we want to be instrumentalist about it. It's got to be investment at large. And I think we're going to have to recognise that subsidy matters. If you cut it back too far, you will kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
And also, just as a small rider to that, it occurs to me that institutions like the Royal Shakespeare Company, the National Theatre, the Royal Opera House, are more able to attract corporate giving than some of the breeding grounds, if you like, out in the regions, which also need to be nurtured.
Well, I think our big institutions need to be supported. They pay back many times over, but absolutely in schools, out in the regions, because who knows where that creative spirit is going to develop. You cannot plan it from Whitehall. I mean, if you think about the Royal Shakespeare Company and Matilda, who would have thought that it would be a global blockbuster? You know, they had to take a risk. Would the Dahl family even actually agree to do it? So these are very long-term things. And the culture and creative industries and the arts are riding high at the moment in this country. But in a way, that's the investment that's gone back years. And we must be careful not to stifle it for the future.
I was very pleased to see, Harriet Harman, that you'd got a song by Reinaldo Ahn, because he's not as well known as, say, Schubert or Schumann or even Hugo Wolf, but he was a wonderful songwriter.
Absolutely, and this is beautifully sung by countertenor Philip Yerusky on his album Opium, a young French countertenor, and it's the setting of a very simple, very beautiful love poem, A Cloïs, at the turn of the 18th century.
Thank you.
Ach, Loris by Reynaldo Ahn, sung by Philippe Jaruski, accompanied by Jérôme Ducrot. Extraordinary to think that within our lifetimes, really, the countertenor has sort of come into its own, because it's such a beautiful sound.
Yes, it's got somehow a purity which just suits the absolute simplicity of that melody and the piano, and that's music just as beauty and as tenderness, not to frighten you or excite you, but just to put you in touch with beauty.
He says to his girlfriend that you have made me love you so much that even the ambrosian fields hold no lure for me if your love for me is as I believe it to be.
Absolutely, and plenty of bearing of his soul, nothing held back there.
You were talking earlier about the sort of velvety quality of the bassoon, and I thought a little bit of that in a countertenor voice. And we're going to hear next one of the great icons of 20th century music, The Rite of Spring. And a lot of people listening to this, Harriet Harman, will think, because you've mentioned the bassoon, that we're going to hear the opening, because it must be one of the most terrifying openings for any bassoonist. And it was such a revolutionary idea to start a piece of music with a bassoon in a register that it had never travelled to before. High C, I think it is.
Yes, it's a very dramatic start, but what's lovely about this is the ballet that goes with it. I've always loved ballet from when I was a child. In fact, I used to go after school to the Ballet Rombert to dance and even did an audition for the Royal Ballet School. Fortunately, I didn't get in, but I've always loved ballet, so ballet music's got a very special place for me, and this is very dramatic again. I think one of the best rites of spring is Pina Bausch, where you have dancers of all ages, and actually some of the most expressive are the older dancers who bring to the dance all the experience of their life with all its ups and downs.
I'm interested you said that, because I assumed when you mentioned you'd been to the Royal Ballet that you were probably going to mention the Kenneth Macmillan Rite of Spring, which indeed is good, but I agree with you. I think that Pina Bausch is more extraordinary in many ways.
There's something about the sharpness of her choreography with the kind of sharpness of the music. I think it's just a perfect match.
Thank you.
There's a visceral quality to that music, isn't there?
It's just the beat that goes all the way through. It's just fantastic.
That was The Sacrificial Dance, the end of The Rite of Spring by Stravinsky, the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Esa-Pekka Salonen. The next music we're going to hear, Harriet Harman, is actually played by the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel. And I imagine that El Sistema, the system in Venezuela, must have been something that gladdened the hearts of all politicians as what might be done, rather in the way the Birmingham Royal Ballet did Romeo and Juliet with all of those kids in Birmingham.
Yes, I think that a lot of people saw this on the proms when the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra, under, you know, the genius that's Gustavo Dudamel, did Mambo from Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story at the proms. And the camera went round all the musicians playing the different instruments, and they looked nothing like your normal orchestra. They were much younger, and they were like street kids. You know, they had rings through their noses and long ringlets, that's the men. But they played with such enthusiasm. And I think the thing is about the opportunities for young people to do music. It's not just about their opportunity to do music, but for us to hear the incredible freshness and passion that they bring that can make you completely wake up and listen in a different way to a piece of music you might have known and loved for years. And I think that of all those young people in Venezuela who found classical music through Il Sistema, you know, surely it's something we can and should do here.
Well, I must put in a word for the National Youth Orchestra, because I've worked with them, and actually they have... It's not quite like that, because the story is not quite as dramatic, and they don't come from such straitened circumstances on the whole. But I did get that wonderful excitement from working with youth orchestras, because when you've actually worked with a symphony orchestra in London, and they're some marvellous musicians, but they're worked very hard, and some of the kind of joy of making music begins to fade a little bit, and then you get young pairs who are suddenly finding what it's like to have this opportunity to play in an orchestra. And it is incredibly revitalising.
But I think what we want is to see all young people who've got the passion and the talent to be able to do that. And the worry is that with the cutbacks and with the emphasis on the so-called academic subjects, that there will be future generations who won't get to the level that you need to get into the National Youth Orchestra, which is already an absolutely fantastic level.
Thank you.
just bursting with Latin exuberance. What a match between that particular orchestra and that incredible score.
That was the Simon Bolivar Youth Orchestra of Venezuela, conducted by Gustavo Dudamel, playing Leonard Bernstein's Mambo from the Symphonic Dances from West Side Story. Now, Harriet, we had a late change of mind, didn't we, about the next piece? Rather, you did, because you were going to have Beim Schlafengehen from Strauss's Four Last Songs, fantastic piece. But you then thought you'd like to change. And one of the reasons was, I think, we always think about, you just talked about Latin America there, but we always assume that the only people that can really conduct streetwise music are American performers like Previn, Tilson Thomas, and one thinks of composers like Gershwin and Cole Porter. However, you have found, you feel, someone here who can do it par excellence.
Well, I think John Wilson has stolen a march on all of them. And Oklahoma, which was very much, I remember the film of my youth, I had the, you know, the old 78 and, you know, played it until it was almost falling apart. But what's incredible is to see John Wilson actually reconstructing lost orchestrations. It's unbelievable to think that they could have lost these orchestrations, but putting them all together by listening and reconstructing them, then creating in the John Wilson Orchestra the very best musicians and bringing this music afresh to a whole new range of listeners, giving it a new lease of life. And I think he's just a phenomenon. I think he's incredible to watch as well. He's not at all what you imagine a conductor to look like. He's this very dapper Geordie, but he's doing brilliantly. And this is a great piece.
Think up stories that link my name with yours.
Why do the neighbors gossip all day behind their doors?
I know a way to prove what they say is quite untrue. Here is the gist, a practical list of don'ts for you.
You were to blame as much as I. Why do you take the trouble to bake my favorite pie? Granting your wish, I carved our initials on the tree. Just keep a slice of all the advice you give so free. My charm too much. Don't look so vain with me. Don't stand in the rain with me. so grand in mind. People will say within love, don't dance all night with me till the stars fade from above.
Rodgers and Hammerstein, People Will Say We're in Love, from Oklahoma. Julian Ovenden and Sierra Boggess were singing, with John Wilson conducting his orchestra. When you look back over your career thus far, Harriet Harman, what are the things that you feel most proud about? I mean, you fought particularly for women's rights, of course, but also many other rights. What are the things that you feel one day people will say, well, these were great achievements?
Well, I think what people say to me when I go around the country campaigning, as I do as deputy leader of the Labour Party, so I go all over the place, is that so many women come up to me and say, you know, when you were speaking up against domestic violence, I felt you were speaking up for me. Or when you were campaigning and saying that there should be more nursery facilities for mothers who were going out to work to provide for their families as well as bringing up their children, that was what I wanted to see happen. So I think that because there were so few women in politics when I started, there was only 3% of women in the House of Commons, is that I had to speak up for women because otherwise it was just only men. So I feel that many times people said to me, oh, don't keep talking about women's issues, about domestic violence and childcare and maternity pay and leave. People will just think you're narrow and pigeonhole you. And actually, half the population was not hearing issues of great concern to them aired in what was supposed to be a representative democracy. So I feel pleased that I did that, but also that it couldn't be just me, and I wanted the House of Commons to have many more women in it so that actually it could be normal to have women's voices heard in public policy debates and in decision-making.
You did pay a price at one point, didn't you, for soldiering on in this direction? I think it was under Tony Blair, that because these issues weren't necessarily mainstream politics.
Yes, well, I did get sacked, and I think in any sacked from the cabinet, I think, you know, in any political life, you see ups and downs. But the point is, if you believe in what you're doing, not to go off and sulk or be bitter, but just try and work out a way forward for the difference that you think you can make. So I think that actually getting sacked and very publicly was a good lesson to me that you can do what you want to do, even, you know, if you're not in high office, if you care about it, you just have to press on.
The final piece, you've had actually some three pieces which are quite terrifying in their way. And you know, you could say link into themes that you've been concerned about in your public life. The final one, The Turn of the Screw by Britain, suggests all kinds of things are going on. And we're never, which is the really frightening thing, able to quite pin them down.
Well, I think that music can often hold up a mirror to society. And if you think of Bartok and the depiction of domestic violence in that, and you think of this Britain with the kind of hints of abuse of children and the loss of innocence, you know, public policy was a bit behind that. We should have been listening to these arts long ago. But I think that Britain, with its centenary this year, we go to the Alborough Festival a lot at Snake Maltings, which has been so wonderfully developed by Jonathan Reakey, and it's just such a pleasure to get to know Britain's repertoire. This is very, very dark, very frightening, very deep, but very beautiful at the same time.
And it's a miracle of orchestration, because with 13 instruments only, he conjures up such glorious sounds. This is the scene, Act 1, Scene 8, at night. And, of course, the story focuses on these two orphans, Miles and Flora, who are being looked after by a governess, but in a house where there are ghosts. And the ghost of Peter Quint, in particular, we hear him beginning to interact with the children. And you're never quite sure, are you, Harriet, what's going on here? Is this a man trying to corrupt a child? Is there a degree in which the child is fascinated? It's that very dangerous line, and you're never quite sure.
Well, the child is trusting and innocent, but thinking itself that they might be doing things wrong, and you know it's going to go from bad to worst, I'm afraid. Very eerie.
Yeah, and this is the moment when they first sort of interact together.
Blandishment of counterfeit. In me secrets half formed desires me.
Secrets, oh secrets.
I am the hidden life that stirs when the candle is upstairs and down, the footsteps barely heard, the unknown gesture, the soft, persistent word. The long sighing
in the wood, on the banks, by the walls, in the long, lush grass, all the wind blows on knees. I wait, I wait, I wait.
On the walls, in the wood, on the banks, by the walls, in the long, lush grass, all the wind blows on knees. I wait, I wait.
In the woods, on the banks, by the moors, in the moors, lush grass, all the wind,
all the wind,
very, very poignant, that, isn't it? My husband Jack and I saw a wonderful production of that at Snake Maltings.
Very interesting at the end, we hear Miles saying, "I am bad, aren't I?"
Mm-hmm.
And of course that accords absolutely with everything one's read about victims feeling guilt and that they somehow brought it upon themselves.
Well, this is, you know, art ahead of public policy makers. Once again, it's all set out there, it just needed people to listen.
Britain's setting of the Henry James story, The Turn of the Screw, Opus 54, which that was Act 1, Scene 8, At Night. We heard Ian Bostridge as Peter Quint, Julian Liang as Miles, Vivian Tierney, Miss Jessel, Caroline Wise, Flora, Joan Rogers, the governess, and Jane Henschel, Mrs. Gross, with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra conducted by Daniel Harding. Wonderful in a way that we can finish Harriet Harman, given what we've been talking about, in a year in which we're celebrating a composer that has risen into international stature as one of the major figures of the 20th century.
Yes, and I think it's great for the centenary to be an opportunity for there to be a focus, and not just in Suffolk and East Anglia, which is obviously Britain is very important, but all around the country. I think it's been a great renaissance for Britain, and how well deserved.
And actually, I mean, I think what has put his name on the map is that his operas are successful all over the world.
It's great to see people getting them. Music is a journey. People suddenly wake up to things and think about them afresh and learn new things.
Harriet Harman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Harriet Harman was talking to Michael Barclay. Next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the installation artist and lighting designer Bruce Munro. That's at the same time next Sunday, midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's programme was Chris Marshall.
Life and Death in the Tudor Court, a season of programmes on BBC Two.
It was a bear pit, primeval, primordial drama.
And central to it all was a commoner who became queen.
She was a woman who chose to step into the tough, political game.
But how did Anne Boleyn become so dangerous she had to die?
She played a winning hand. Ultimately, she lost.
With contributions from Hilary Mantel and David Starkey, The Last Days of Anne Boleyn, Thursday night at 9 on BBC Two and BBC Two HD.
Well, back here on BBC Radio 3, our Wagner 200 celebrations continue apace during the day. In this week's Words and Music, actors Juliet Stevenson and Michael Pennington read prose and poetry combined with music, evoking the spirit and art of Richard Wagner, including writings about him from those who knew him, his wife Cosima and the philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche. That's from 6:30 this evening. And followed on by our Sunday feature, Wagner, the Making of a National Hero. Stephen Johnson exploring the worlds of the Wagnerian stage heroes, Tannhäuser, Lohengrin, Siegfried and Parsifal among them. The Sunday feature is at 7:45. And speaking of Wagnerian heroes, in just a couple of minutes, the early music show takes us back to the most human of them all, the real Hans Sachs and his fellow master singers in 17th century Nuremberg, immortalised by Wagner in his opera Die Meistersinger von Nuremberg. BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM. We're on digital radio. You can also listen to us live online in high-definition sound. It's 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by me, Jonathan Swain. The Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has insisted that the Conservative Party is absolutely united on the issue of Britain's relationship with the European Union. He was responding to comments made by the former Foreign Secretary, Lord Howe, who said David Cameron seemed to be losing control of his party and was running scared of his Eurosceptic MPs by trying to renegotiate the terms of Britain's membership of the EU before holding a referendum. Pressure's also mounting on the Prime Minister over the legalisation of gay marriage, which will be debated in the Commons next week. Senior Tory activists will shortly deliver a letter to Downing Street in which they call for the measure to be abandoned. The Pakistani politician and former cricketer Imran Khan has denounced the killing of a senior member of his party as a targeted act of terror. Zahra Shahid Hussain was shot outside her home in Karachi just hours before a repeat election was to be held in the area of the city due to allegations of vote rigging. Her funeral will take place within the next hour. Reports from Syria say government troops have launched an offensive to recapture the rebel-held town of Qusayr after weeks of fighting in the surrounding area. Syrian state television said government forces had surrounded terrorists in the town and had destroyed what it called nests of their leaders. The Foreign Office is investigating reports that French police are questioning a British man in connection with the deaths of his two children. The bodies of the 5- and 10-year-olds were found at their flat in Lyon yesterday afternoon. The authorities say they've arrested a 48-year-old divorced British man. Talks between the police and Republican and Loyalist leaders from Northern Ireland have ended with a commitment to non-violence. 2 days of discussions were held in Cardiff aimed at resolving tension ahead of the marching season. And finally, the weather, a dry and bright afternoon for many northern and central parts, although it'd be rather dull near eastern coasts. Cloudier in the south, with showers near the south coast. Tonight, cloudy with rain or drizzle in most places by dawn. And that's the BBC News and Weather, with a time at 1:02. And now, as promised here on Radio 3, the early music show, and as part of our Wagner 200 celebrations, Lucy Skeeping looks back on the original Master Singers of Nuremberg.
A few months ago, I found myself with a couple of days to spare in Nuremberg. It's everything you'd imagine a real old German town to be. A fairy tale silhouette of pointy roofs and wood-beamed houses, tall rounded towers, and here and there fountains with lifelike statues of the city's great and good. The powerful burghers and civic guildsmen who remind us of Nuremberg's proud past as the home of some of Germany's most important merchant families. Just up the hill towards the medieval castle, you can pop into the corner house that once belonged to the artist Dürer, his kitchen and print shop now beautifully restored. And a little further down across the Pegnitz River stands the statue of one of the city's most important inhabitants, the 16th century shoemaker and master songsmith Hans Sachs. Little did he know that 300 years on, he'd be the star of one of the 19th century's most beloved operatic works, Wagner's Meistersinger.
Thank you.
colourful entrance of the guild apprentices, the journeymen and the master singers themselves, including the hero of it all, the great Hans Sachs. Part of Act 3 of Wagner's most ebullient opera, his anthem to the glory of German art, the master singers of Nuremberg. If you're familiar with Wagner's opera, you'll know that he based it on real 16th century German customs and characters. Hans Sachs really did exist. The guilds of cobblers, tailors, bakers and so on that make up a large part of the opera's chorus were an integral part of town life at the time. And the song competition, judged by the masters and their guildsmen, which forms the dramatic backbone of the opera, was likewise based on fact. It was in the 1840s, when he was musical director to the Royal Court in Dresden, that Wagner began reading in earnest about the history of the master singers. And he was fascinated by what he discovered. Their singing contests were actually an attempt to revive the art of love song as practiced by the medieval knights. What's more, they were extremely particular about how these songs were constructed. Each one had to follow a prescribed set of vigorous rules, so they weren't just a means of artistic expression, but a badge by which the influential mercantile classes could demonstrate their mastery over craft and art. And in the hands of the honest artisans of Nuremberg, the songs took on an eccentric, provincial quality, a workmanlike obsession with rules, titles and tradition that Wagner found both amusing and irresistible.